Exodus chapter 34, verse 29, we've just seen God give the tablets to Moses yet again after Moses smashed the tablets in a fit of anger after the tragic episode of the golden calf. That's beginning to recede now into the distance because God has renewed his covenant. He has told Moses that he is faithful to his word, that he will be with his people, that he will not abandon his people, and that he will see them through. When I was in ninth grade, I went to Italy. And I went to Italy because, again, my mom was the Latin teacher, and she would take groups to Italy. And while in Rome, we were able to see Michelangelo's great statue of Moses. And there it is. And when I first saw it, I said, Moses, because it was Moses. And it's unbelievable. Moses has kept that posture for all these years. Hasn't blinked. If you try to win a staring contest, it will not go well. He will win. But that's Michelangelo's famous statue of Moses. What's interesting about it, as we move to the next slide, is his head. And it's caused no end of speculation and questioning. Art snobs debate and argue about this. What are the two horns coming out of Moses' head, and why are there two horns coming out of Moses' head? It's intriguing because they're not really great horns, and you're dealing with Michelangelo, who certainly could have put very accurate-looking horns of some sort or another, but they're odd-looking horns. What are they? Well, it goes back to the interpretation of our passage, Exodus 34, the latter passage of Exodus 34, when Exodus says that Moses came down from the mountain and his face was shining, and his face was shining so brightly that he had to put a veil over his face, and when he would talk with God, he would lift the veil off of his face, and when he was through talking with God, he would put the veil over his face. When St. Jerome translated the Bible into Latin, he translated what's called the Vulgate. The Vulgate, V-U-L-G-A-T-E, is the official Latin translation of the Bible, which is the official Bible of the Catholic Church. The word for shining is a word that can mean shining or light, and another meaning is horn. So Jerome translated it as horn. Michelangelo, as a Catholic, used the Latin Vulgate and put horns on Moses' head because of St. Jerome's translation of the word as horn instead of shining. However, Michelangelo does not seem to be unaware of the translation issue because it seems to be a kind of combination of horns and rays of light. So the thought is that those are supposed to indicate rays of light. Other art historians point out that horns are signs of authority and power and were oftentimes in classical art put on people as a symbol of power. So there's a lot going on there, but I just show that to you. I stood there and looked at that and I thought, that is absolutely fascinating. And what I like about it is it shows that even then, when Michelangelo was chiseling that out of marble, people were trying to understand how to depict what happened to Moses. What happened to Moses? Why was his face shining with light? I want to talk about that this evening. The first point I want to make this evening is this, that God's glory is contagious. God's glory is contagious. Let's begin with Exodus chapter 34, verse 29. When Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand, as he came down from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because he had been talking with God. Well, first of all, Moses, who wrote Exodus, gives us the exact answer as to what is happening. What is happening is His face is shining because he had been talking with God. Light and the shining of light is oftentimes used in the Bible to speak of the glory of God, whether it's fire or a kind of blinding light. And we see that especially in the New Testament as well. I mean, if you think about John chapter 1 and John's great descriptions of Jesus, John said that the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome or comprehended it. John, by the way, in particular, not only in his Gospels, but in his letters, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, seems to have loved the image of light as a symbol of the glory of God. And that may be because John, who was writing at the end of the first century, may have been interacting with early forms of Gnosticism and false teachings. Gnostics had a heavy emphasis on light and darkness as symbols and types of good and evil. Regardless, it can't be just that, because light is used all throughout. As we'll see in a moment, you'll remember what happened when Jesus takes the inner circle up onto the Mount of Transfiguration. But the point I want to make is this: there seems to be a contagiousness about God's glory. Moses is in the presence of God, and after he leaves the presence of God, his face shines. And I just want to say to us tonight that you can never truly be in the presence of God and not be changed as a result. Our lives should shine brightly because we are in the presence of God. And this is something that Mrs. Richardson says to me and to Hannah. She'll text sometimes and say, "Shine, hope you shine today." And I always think, well, I'm deathly pale. I mean, honestly, if I go out in the sun, I look like that. Do you remember that scene in those terrible Twilight movies when Edward Cullen, he went to see the Volturi in Italy, and he took off his shirt. He was a vampire. There's a point to this. And he glistened in the light. I'm kind of like that, except for I'm not handsome and fit, and I don't drink blood. And there's really no other parallel. But in terms of general paleness, neither am I fast or strong, and I'm not good at baseball. But other than that, I could have been in the movie. I could have played that part in the movie. But when you're in the presence of God, truly, some of you don't know what just happened in the last 60 seconds. But let me say that if you had a teenage son or daughter, you would know what I'm saying. You would know if you were on Team Edward or what was that wolf kid's name? What? Jacob. Yeah, Jacob. Yeah, he was the hunky wolf kid. Anyway, I was on Team Popcorn through that whole ordeal. But when you're in the presence of God, it alters you. It changes you. It affects who you are. And I love the idea of God's glory as contagious, because it's a good picture. God's glory goes airborne with God's people. When you're in his presence, when you're worshiping him, when you're communing with God, when you are with God in prayer. Have you ever been around Christians who had a dynamic walk with the Lord and they almost seemed to just radiate the joy and goodness of God? There was a kind of attractive, life-giving appeal about their walk. You wanted to be near them. You felt closer to God because you knew that they had been with God. You see this dynamic, sure enough, in Matthew chapter 17. Listen to this account of the Transfiguration. "And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his face shone like the sun." What does this sound like? It sounds like Moses. "And his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. And Peter said to Jesus, 'Lord, it is good that we are here. If you wish, I will make 3 tents here,' he says, 'one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah.' He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." Notice the continuation of the imagery of light. Jesus is transfigured into light, and then the shadow, the cloud that overshadows them, is a cloud of light. It is a bright light-bringing cloud. The contagious glory of God. If it is true that the glory of God is contagious, then it is a question of how someone can profess to be a believer and not reflect God's glory. If your life gets darker, even as you continue religious exercises and devotions, it is probably because your life has just become that, a religious exercise. But I mean a real dynamic walk with Jesus. Getting up and asking, how can I honor and walk with and obey the Lord today? It's impossible not to shine with the glory of God. Secondly, this, number two, and you're asking yourself, by the way, why is he turning his notes that much? That's because the printer decided to print these off in massive font. So I've got like 6 words on each piece of paper. I've got like 50 pages of notes up here. I need a professional note turner. I'm just exhausted with this thing. Anyway, I basically have that on my notes as opposed to just one page. So I just want to address the elephant in the room. If you're like, for the love of Pete, that guy killed a small forest for a Wednesday night. That's true. That's true. Look at verse 30. Aaron and all the people of Israel saw Moses, and behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. But Moses called to them. By the way, that's kind of a funny scene. Moses comes down the mountain. They're like, what is that? His face is shining with bright light. And they're all like, Moses on the mountain. I mean, they just don't want to be near him. He has to say, hey, fellas, it's just me. His face is beaming. I think it's kind of funny. But Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the leaders of the congregation returned to him, and Moses talked with them. Afterward, all the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. I just want you to notice the dynamic that when we are in the presence of God and the contagious glory of God begins to be reflected off of us in our lives, it goes public. People know it. Afterward, all the people of Israel came near, and he commanded them all that the Lord had spoken with him in Mount Sinai. And when Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. I love that. It makes me think, by the way, of Nathaniel Hawthorne's great short story, The Minister's Black Veil. You remember that story? Most of you read The Scarlet Letter and swore off Porter Nathaniel Hawthorne forever, and in so doing you missed The Minister's Black Veil, which is a story about a preacher in a New England town, and one day out of the blue he comes to church and he's wearing a veil. And so people think, like, his face is covered. He preaches his sermon, he leaves, and people start talking. It'd be like if I came with a veil. Y'all would say, well, it must be a sermon illustration. But then the next Sunday he showed up and he still had the veil. The third Sunday and the fourth Sunday, the preacher got up, he still had a veil. Whenever he walked around town, he wore a veil. Well, people's bemusement turned to irritation, and then it turned to anger. Hawthorne says they began to send people to him. They sent the deacons, and they said, look, people are disturbed by this. You need to remove the veil. And he said, I'm not doing anything wrong. I want to wear the veil. Finally, the preacher's a single guy in the story, and there's a girl who loved him, and they had kind of dated. Finally, his girlfriend comes to him, maybe his fiance, I don't remember, and she says, will you not take the veil off just for me? And he refuses. He says, I will never take the veil off. People begin to be afraid of him. Hawthorne says some are repelled by his presence. They see the veil as an ominous symbol that something must be wrong with the minister. People start going crazy around him. And yet some, he said, finds that it gives his sermons a certain strange magnetic power. People tremble when he preaches. They're drawn into the mystery of it. The veil just has an amazing effect on everyone. Either people hate it and flee from him, or they're drawn to him. It becomes just something. And Hawthorne says, year after year after year, the minister preaches and ministers, and people with the veil, and people just finally begrudgingly accept it. On his deathbed, the town gathers round, and the church people gather round, and Hawthorne says they're in his bedroom, and he's on his deathbed, and he's about to die. And one of the men says, won't you just take that veil off? And one of them curses him and says, you must have done something evil. It must be a symbol. It must be a symbol that you have a veil over your soul. And the guy speaks up and he says, I wear this veil. I wear it as a symbol of a struggle and of a problem. And he said, when I look around me, I look at all of you, and behold, on every visage I see a black veil. And then he dies. Anyway, it's a real uplifting story. But the point of it is that he decided to wear outwardly what everyone else was doing inwardly. He was making the point that everyone's hiding something. That's the point of the story. Everyone's hiding something, according to the story. And he says, all of you are wearing veils. Why am I wrong for doing outwardly what all of you are doing inwardly? Why am I wrong for acting out your own hearts? It's a powerful story. But when I think about Moses' veil, I think it wasn't a symbol that something was wrong. It was a symbol that something was so unbelievably right that people couldn't handle it. The resplendent Shekinah glory of God radiating off of Moses' face. When Moses had finished speaking with them, verse 33, he put a veil over his face. And whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would remove the veil until he came out. And when he came out and told the people of Israel what he was commanded, the people of Israel would see the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face was shining, and Moses would put the veil over his face again until he went in to speak with him. What I'm trying to tell you is that this was not simply an exceptional moment, something that only happens once. Whether it literally happens or not, the fact is, if you are communing as you should with the Lord God, people will see and notice. It is impossible to have a purely private relationship with Jesus. And if you have a relationship with Jesus, the thought of it being purely private should be distasteful to you. You should want the light to shine. And you should want the glory to shine. The fact of the matter is, when all is said and done, after all of our talk about evangelism and witnessing, the most powerful witness you can ever have is a life that reflects the glory of God. This is why Peter says to wives, he says, if you are living with a husband who is not a godly man and you want to win him back, he tells wives, win him without a word as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. And I remember the first time I ever used that in marriage counseling. It was at another church. It was a lady who had come to me and said, my husband's neglectful of me. My husband doesn't show me affection. My husband doesn't buy me birthday presents. My husband doesn't open the door. He doesn't take me to dinner. He doesn't spend time with me. He's neglectful. He's not who he's supposed to be. And he's hurt me. And I'm offended. And he's hurt me. And every day I tell him that. I tell him you've hurt me. And I tell him that you need to be a godlier man and that Christian men don't act like this. And she started crying and she said, I tell him all the time. And she said, what do you think I should do? And I said, quit telling him. I forget, she said, well, then how will he ever change? I said, because that's not working. And I read to her what Peter said, win him without a word. I said, here's what you do. You follow Jesus so radically that the Holy Spirit's presence in your life becomes a built-in critique and challenge. You cannot do to your husband what only God can do. I say that to husbands too. You meet people all the time, they're like, I preach at him all the time. He just gets madder and madder. Well, just maybe you should stop preaching at him. Peter understood the male ego. He understood that the average guy, no guy is ever badgered into the kingdom. And you might say, well, it makes it sound like it's the woman's fault. I don't think that at all. I think the guy was completely wrong. However, why do we underestimate the power of God to change a heart as they observe your changed heart? The most powerful thing you can do is to simply consistently, joyfully, lovingly follow Jesus around your lost friends. Now, lest you hear that and walk out of here and say, that's terrible. I'm not saying there's never a time to speak. I'm not saying wives should, you know, long-sufferingly never correct their husband. There is a time to speak. I'm just saying that you're speaking even when you're not speaking. And the most powerful speaking is the life you're living when you're not speaking. That's why you meet wives all the time who understand this point, who will say, I finally had to turn him over to the Lord, right? They understood. I can preach all day, he just seems to get a hardened heart. Or I can let him see the glory. So, if you have a spouse, a husband or wife, who won't go to church, he won't go to church, and every Sunday you say, why won't you go to church? And you have these big, fantastic arguments. Quit asking him to go to church. Get up and dress the kids and take them to church. And do it every single Sunday joyfully. And while he's sitting there pretending not to watch when you go out the door, he's watching. And eventually, because I've heard guys literally say it, eventually he will break under the shame of you being obedient while he's not being obedient. See what I'm saying? The glory that you reflect has more weight than the words that you articulate. There is a place for words, but glory works too. Let it work. Bless those who curse you. Refuse to be a part of the evil game of returning cruelty with cruelty. And follow Jesus. The same with husbands. There are plenty of guys whose wives won't go. Just go. Go and model it. About the worst thing you can do, by the way, is I've heard spouses say, he didn't want to go, so I quit going in an effort that I could minister to him. No spouse has ever been won by your disobedience. You go. Just go. I'm preaching to the choir. You're here. But I'm saying encourage your friends. Let them know, hey, the glory works. People see the glory. Look at Acts 4:13. That's a little marriage counseling stuff. You're welcome. Acts 4:13. Now when they saw, watch this. Just watch. Now when they, the lost, saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were uneducated men, uneducated common men, they were astonished and they recognized that they had been with Jesus. There it is. Nowhere in that verse is there a reference to them preaching, even though we know they were constantly preaching, right? But the point is, alongside their words were their lives. Your life is a sermon. So preachers always say at funerals, you preach your own funeral. That's true, but you also preach sermons every day. When you're at work and that person says that horrible thing to you and you want to react in anger and you don't, you've just preached a sermon. You preach the sermon that your contentment is in Christ, not in some need for vengeance. So reflect the glory. Lastly, this should say three, not two, but the last point is this. We are called to be glory reflectors. With all of this in mind, let's consider again the well-known words of Matthew 5. You are the light of the world. Now just think about that. Have you ever asked yourself the question? Everyone knows that verse, right? And when you're a kid in vacation Bible school, You remember this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Come on, Ronnie. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine. What's the next verse? Won't let, what is it? Yeah, I'm confused now. Anyway, you're not gonna let Satan it out and all the other things. But have you ever asked yourself the question, what is the nature of that light? My point is that we should allow Exodus 34, 29 and onwards to define Matthew 5, 14. The light that you are to shine is the reflected light of the glory of God. My fear is that we think of it as inherent light, self-generated light. That when I'm good, people see light. That's true, but when you're good, it is not self-originating light, self-generated light. It is always reflected light. The light you are to let shine is light that shines by bouncing off of you from God. It is God's glory. It is the same light that shone on the face of Moses. So what he is saying here in verse 15, a city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket. Stop wearing a veil. Don't cover the light of God that is intended to reflect in your life. Every time I hear someone say, well, I have my private life and I have my public life, I think there's a word for that. It's hypocrisy. Your private life should be your public life. You know what I mean? So you let the light of God reflect off of you. Nor do people put a light on a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others. Watch. So that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven. They are catching the reflected light of God's glory, being changed by it, and then handing it back to Him. Come on now, that'll preach. God shines on you. Everyone sees it. They are altered by it. They step into the light by observing deed and word of yours, and they receive the light of truth, and then they give God glory. That means that God's glory keeps making loops throughout humanity, coming back to Him through the conduit of your life. It begins in Him, reflects off of you, goes to those around you, and then is offered back to God by them. That's pretty awesome. I gotta say, for a Wednesday night, that's a pretty good point. That's how God's glory works. So here's my word to you. Mrs. Richardson is gonna get the last word tonight. And there's one thing I've learned. It's good to let Mrs. Richardson have the last word. And the last word is this: shine. Shine. Don't cover it. Don't be ashamed of it. Just let it shine. Be who God has made you to be, and everything and everyone around you will be changed. Pray with me.